From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. This past week, we witnessed great presidential and political drama in Texas, and also saw the release of controversial data about sexual violence on campus. Hi, I'm Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. Our program today has two segments. Our opening conversation will focus on the presidential drama at the University of Texas in Austin, where over the July 4th holiday, President Bill Powers was told to resign or be fired. And our second segment will focus on the National Survey of Sexual Violence on Campus, released on Wednesday by Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. Our first conversation today is about being forced out in Austin. I'm pleased to welcome Hunter Rawlings III, who is president of the Association of American Universities and the former president, past president of Cornell University, and Scott Jasek, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Thank you both for joining us. By way of background, the July 4th holiday was anything but quiet and calm at the University of Texas in Austin. What campus leaders now characterize as the July 4th coup, President Bill Powers was informed that he should step down or he would be fired by UT System Chancellor Francisco Cigueroa. The episode brings back memories of recent events at the University of Virginia, where a powerful board chair attempted to sack a popular and well-respected president, who eventually retained her position, and also a situation at the University of Oregon, where a president clashed with regents over institutional autonomy and was subsequently dismissed. Moreover, Texas is just the most current in a long chain of similar events going back to 1967, when then-California Governor Ronald Reagan sacked the University of California President Clark Kerr. The Texas controversy was seemingly resolved on Wednesday afternoon when Chancellor Cigueroa announced an agreement allowing President Powers to remain at the helm of the Austin campus until May 2015. But the underlying issues remain, and in Texas, as elsewhere, the core issues in these matters seem to be the continuing tension about autonomy versus accountability, and also questions about public leadership and public agendas. Scott, please give us a little bit more background. What else do we need to know about the situation in Texas?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to say that they have been fighting in Texas over the role of a public research university. Think tanks and regents who are close to Governor Rick Perry have questioned the value of research programs if they don't land huge outside research grants, and that means effectively they're questioning humanities and some social science programs. They've questioned the value of small classes, which are key to any graduate institution. So there's been a lot of bickering about the role of a public research university, and Bill Powers has been a strong defender of the tradition of a public research university, clashing with regents repeatedly. So this didn't come out of nowhere, even though people were really surprised on July 4th. And I think it really does speak to, is there political understanding of the many roles of a public research university?
Hunter Rawlings, are there other aspects of the relationship between the president of the UT campus, the chancellor, and the regents, and even the governor that are unique to Texas that also color this event?
Well, I would say Scott is correct in pointing out that this struggle has been going on now for several years. So what makes this unusual is the fact that it's not a one-time event. It's a series of events that have followed one another over the course of really 3 or 4 years now, ever since Governor Perry came out with his 7 ideas for transforming universities. So this has been a lengthy battle, and it started with the 7 breakthrough solutions, as Governor Perry called them.
Chancellor Cigueroa said a lot about, in a number of forms, that there was not one event that led to his decision to request the resignation or force President Powers out, but in fact it was a series, as you both indicated. And he talked about communication. What constitutes effective communication between a president, a chancellor, a board, and the governor? Hunter?
Well, I think there needs to be regular communication so that there are no surprises. Everyone knows what the other is going to say in advance, if at all possible, and you have a good working relationship. And we see that in a number of states where it seems to me there's a good understanding of the role of a research university. These universities play a very strong role in states, not only in terms of education and research, but technology transfer and innovation. These research universities are enormously important now to their states, and everyone needs to understand that.
Scott, in Texas, as in Virginia, faculty seem to play a big role. Lots of activity in terms of faculty leaders and others strongly supporting President Powers, and even a statement that reported by Inside Higher Ed today that the president or the leader of the Board of Regents was dismayed by the response of faculty in terms of the leadership of the regents. Talk a little more about the faculty role, if you would, please.
Well, it really stands out because these are tough times to lead public research universities. And there are a lot of faculty members at research universities and other kinds of colleges who are cynical or even hostile to their leaders. And I was really struck by the number of faculty members at Texas who were saying it's not just that they prefer their president to their governor, but they talked about how Powers had come through for them, had sought opportunities to advance their interests, had recognized the breadth of disciplines that are important to a university, had defended the value of diversity in a university, which isn't always an easy political position to take. It was really impressive to me from afar how many faculty felt very personally connected to a president, and at an institution as mammoth as UT Austin, that's not an easy task.
One of the other attributes of this seemed that differentiated from the one at Virginia 2 years ago, Hunter, was it seemed that President Powers was not fighting to keep his job, but just hold out of the job through the current year to end a couple of cycles in terms of a large development campaign, opening of a medical school, and some have argued also to deny Governor Perry some influence in the replacement of his successor. Is that a fair assessment in terms of how this ultimately played out? The chancellor got the president to resign, and they ultimately were just negotiating over an exit date?
Well, I think to some extent that is true, but President Powers has emphasized that, frankly, the politics of this don't interest him very much. He's tried to stay away from the political aspects of it, and he's focused on the campaign. He's running for UT Austin. He's focused on changing the culture in terms of teaching undergraduate students and improving graduation rates. I think he's focused on what a university president should be spending his attention on. So that, to him, I think, was the essence of it. He stood up for the values of UT Austin and research universities in general, and it came down, I think, in the end to that. So he was able to negotiate what seems to me to be a reasonable compromise.
But, Scott, even as the principals have denied political motives in this process, certainly there's been lots of commentary from other sources that, in fact, you know, part of what was going on here was an effort to deny Governor Perry an opportunity to influence the appointment of the next president of the University of Texas.
And actually, I think this again speaks to a larger principle, and part of what upset so many people at the University of Virginia 2 years ago and Texas now is this sense of a force from the board just declaring it's time to change without any sense of why, and running counter to faculty sentiment, student sentiment, alumni sentiment. I think everyone understands that boards of trustees do have the power to hire and fire presidents and chancellors. But at a public university, there is also the idea of multiple constituencies who should have a say. And at Virginia and at Texas, the sense that for no public reason, somebody who appears to be doing their job not just well, but perhaps exemplary, could out of the blue be removed, I think that really struck a lot of people as going against the traditions of shared governance, that faculty have a role to play, even if the board is making the ultimate decision.
Well, again, let's shift this a little bit. If President Powers was incredibly productive in terms of development, in terms of his relationship with faculty, in terms of a number of different metrics, both in Texas and in elsewhere, Hunter Rawlings, what are the attributes of a productive relationship, particularly as we've seen across most states, declining public support, financial support for state institutions, and rising tension, if you will, either with regents and campus leaders, or in some cases groups in the legislature, about issues of funding, accountability, autonomy, and, you know, even more directly, what are the appropriate fields of study? Should we be educating, or should we be training for jobs?
Well, that's a very good question, and these points you just raised are the ones that are at issue in state after state. Let me give an example, or a couple actually, of very positive developments in several states. In the state of Florida, where problems were certainly being raised a couple of years ago by Governor Scott, and there was a great concern that Florida would follow Texas in this kind of lengthy, long, drawn-out battle, things have quieted in Florida very, very much. The governor has turned around and become a real supporter of higher education, and particularly of leading research universities. He has designated the University of Florida for special status. He has given it extra funding in this year's cycle. He has said publicly that they want to have one of the great research universities in the country. Now, what caused this turnaround? I think it was some very good conversations, very productive conversations between the governor on the one hand and President Manchin of the University of Florida and his board. I think they all came together and said it's important to the state to have a flourishing research university or two, in fact. So they've made real strides in Florida, and I would point to that as a very positive example. The other case I would briefly describe is the state of Michigan, where there have been terrible funding problems because of the auto industry. In Michigan, a group called Business Leaders for Michigan, led by Doug Rothwell, has built a very strong case for making universities accountable through stringent measures, but also then rewarding them if they do well by looking to add state funding rather than subtract. And I'd say that's a very mature approach in Michigan, and I see it as one that could be used elsewhere.
Well, Scott, though, but given the sort of the political tensions that we see between state capitals and university, public universities in general, and leading research universities in particular, is there something different about this cycle in terms of the conversation about autonomy versus accountability that differentiates what's happening now in Texas, what happened in Virginia, what happened in Oregon, and a number of other places compared to what we've seen in the past?
Well, one, you've got many states in tight budget situations. Even as things are a little better than they were a few years ago, states are in recovery mode, and so they're undoing damage rather than adding. But there are also political plays being made that, again, don't always understand the role of a public research university. For instance, the University of Iowa, an institution Hunter knows well, is getting a lot of grief for the fact that they have out-of-state students, and a very, very strong push there to punish the university financially for not having more Iowans. Now, at many universities, out-of-state students are certainly a source of revenue, but they also are part of the experience provided to Iowans of being educated with a broad group of students. And so you have these issues come up now that just suggests that not everyone is on the same page about what a public research university should be.
Well, and Hunter, let's come back to that in terms of same page about a public research university. One, has that vision of a public research university changed in the last decade or the last three? And going forward, what is that vision of a public research university?
Well, a couple of answers there, it seems to me. For one thing, I think there's a real loss of faith now in the older vision we used to have, that strong public education is a public good, that it's something that all people in the state should benefit from. I mean, after all, when I was growing up and going to college, the University of California was free. University of Texas was free, no tuition, because those states believed that it was critically important in a democracy to have citizens of the state well-educated at public universities. This has changed to a great extent recently, and it's become much worse after our recession, because now many people regard higher education as a private good. It's something that individuals should pay for or borrow for. States have been reducing funding, as both of you have been pointing out. So that's, I think, a critical change that has taken place. It's very unfortunate. We all understand the reasons why states are strapped nowadays, but it's had a huge impact on the view of public universities. And then the second point is related to what Scott was saying, and that is that the role of research is not as well appreciated as it might be. The role it plays in innovation and in creating a competitive economy, this is incredibly important in the country. It's not as well understood as it should be, and that's something where it seems to me we're going to have to do a better job of educating political leaders.
But are these tensions going to go away? I mean, I think of states like Colorado, Michigan, California, elsewhere, where the state support for the instructional function of public universities has fallen, in some cases, to single digits and even very low single digits. The state owns the building, it owns the books, if you will, and yet leaves universities with very little control over their financial future, Hunter. How does that public research university mission play out in an environment where there's little control over the finances and potentially, again, tensions with the regents and the legislature about the mission?
It's created a lot of stress at public universities, but in the positive cases, and I've cited a couple, it seems to me now that there is a way forward, and that is to do the best possible job of educating students and to say right from the beginning, this is a high priority at the university. I do think we at universities lost a little bit of our way when we privileged research so strongly and began to withdraw some of our public support for teaching undergraduate students. That has really turned around recently. Leaders like Bill Powers made a huge point of saying that educating students, undergraduates as well as graduate students, is a very high priority. We have to spend a lot of time and effort on it. So that's one very positive thing to do, and it's really working in some cases, I think, by sending a strong message. And then we have to explain research better, as I said earlier, and make the case for it. And when we do, I think both parties of politicians really find it an overwhelmingly positive argument.
Great. My thanks, Hunter, for joining us for the conversation about what's going on in Texas. In our second segment today, we'd like to talk about the McCaskill Survey of Sexual Violence on Campus. And joining us are Laura Dunn, the Executive Director of Serve Justice, which provides assistance to survivors of sexual campus violence and works on all fronts to decrease the prevalence of sexual violence. Kevin Kruger is the president of NASPA, the Association of Student Affairs Administrators in Higher Ed, and of course, Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. By way of background, on Wednesday, Senator and former sex crime prosecutor Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri, released the results of her national survey focused on how four-year colleges and universities handle sexual violence on campus. The survey summary offers a dire assessment, quote, "Institutions are failing to comply with the law and best practices in handling sexual violence on campus. These failures include failing to have a Title IX coordinator, not knowing the scope of the problem on their campuses because of inadequate outreach, not responding to reports of sexual violence made by students, not training students, faculty, and staff on preventing and responding to sexual violence, and having biased or harmful sexual assault adjudication procedures. Although there have been some improvements over the last decade, there's clearly still much work to be done," end quote. The survey follows the aggressive efforts of the Obama administration begun late in April to address sexual violence on campus, and the survey has generated significant controversy. For example, the American Council on Education has called the survey unfair and incomplete and says the survey report, quote, "draws unwarranted conclusions and ignores how hard colleges and universities are working to address this serious and complex societal issue." Laura Dunn, What has the survey told us? What new information do we have? What information do we have that confirms what we know?
I mean, I think generally when I first looked at the survey, it was confirming what I think the nation is starting to suspect, that colleges really are not in compliance with federal law, that there is, you know, a giant problem with sexual violence. We've already had surveys that confirmed it. But part of the reason we have such a problem is that the institutions that are supposed to be on the front line just really haven't prepared over the last couple of decades. I know, obviously, since the Dear Colleague letter in 2011, there's been more attention, but these laws have been in place, Title IX since the 70s and the Clery Act since the early 90s. Colleges have not been serious about complying with these laws for that long period. So I think this survey is just showing the real scope of what colleges have not been doing over the decades and the real cost that it has at the end of the day for survivors.
Kevin Kruger, in many instances, responsibility for investigations into these matters fall under the domain of student affairs professionals. And some of the items in the survey that generated the most response, and let's be fair, in some cases the most outrage, with a finding that at many campuses, these investigations are run by the athletic department, and a large number of campuses, 2 in 5, reported no investigation over the past 5 years. What do you do with that? I mean, you know, what's behind that, and where do you go with that if you are somebody on campus or, in your case, the head of a national association that's trying to work with campus professionals to address these issues?
Yeah. Let me first by saying, you know, the study, the survey provides, you know, needed additional attention to a really serious issue on campus. So let me start with that. I'm troubled by the notion that athletic departments would be in charge of sexual assault cases, and I got to say that's simply a problem with the survey itself. When no campus today, no modern campus is having a athletic department adjudicate sexual assault cases. It's just simply not happening. They may have, and they answered the survey to say that they are actually taking action against athletes, but all the common practice, as outlined by OCR, is that there's a campus judicial process that manages sexual assault. I don't think that the survey got answers that actually reflected the reality about that issue. There's not a prevailing a sense that the athletic departments are doing this and are in charge of sexual assault on campus.
Kevin, let me interrupt you with the survey.
Yeah.
Kevin, let me interrupt you. So are you saying that there are other data that would counter the claim in the survey that, in fact, there are instances where athletic departments are primarily responsible for supervising the, athletes in this instance and take the lead in investigations?
What I would say is you have to, the questions just were not phrased in a way that gets the data you need. I know specifically people who answered that survey who said their athletic department was involved in sexual assault because they may remove a student from an athletic team. They may have their own sanctions, but that's not in place of a campus judicial process that would investigate a sexual assault. So I just don't think, I think that's a 20 year ago, maybe 20 years ago, coaches were doing this, but that is just simply not the way campuses today are doing that. And there's just no data that supports that to be a practice in today's college and universities.
And what about the no investigations from 2 in 5 campuses? Again, are there other data?
This issue that there are no investigations in campuses, I think, reflects some of the things that Laura and other folks would identify, and that we need to make sure that every campus is in compliance with the OCR guidelines, and when a sexual assault is reported, there should be an investigation. However, when a sexual assault is reported to a confidential source, and that student does not want a hearing or an investigation, we also need to acknowledge that not every victim wants a investigation and a hearing. So there's lots of reasons why a specific case may not be investigated and adjudicated from a sexual assault standpoint. We need to not re-traumatize victims by forcing them to proceed with an investigation. So it's a very complex issue.
Scott, we said that the response to this was controversial on both sides. Some of the other, can tell us a little bit more about some of the other controversial aspects, if you would, please.
Sure. Well, I mean, there was a debate over whether colleges were appropriately cooperating with it, with this survey. But let's leave aside for a second, you know, what percentage of colleges may have once let athletic departments supervise these cases. What about the role of athletics generally in these cases? We have a story today about the same day this survey was being released. It was leaking that a college was recruiting a basketball player who had been suspended for 10 years from the University of Oregon for sexually assaulting a female classmate.
Mm.
And before he was at Oregon, he was suspended from someplace else for alleged sexual assault. And here you have a college going out and recruiting him. A number of the cases that have drawn the most attention have in fact involved athletes who appear to have gotten help from their athletic officials, whether or not the athletic department was in charge. And I think that raises a lot of questions, even when many of those they attacked were in fact other athletes. So the idea that there's not an athletics issue here, I question.
Well, Scott, this is Kevin. I'm going to jump in on that. I didn't say it's not an athletics issue. I think the issue related to athletics, Greek life related to sexual assault is substantial, and the, you know, no one would think that the case you just identified is appropriate. You know, students should not be able to bounce from institution to institution, whether athlete or not. But it, clearly, athletics and the culture of athletics is a significant issue related to sexual assault.
Laura Dunn, I want to turn the conversation a little bit. I think that for many of us who read the report, one of the new points of information was the issue of standard of proof. Federal mandates require that institutions take actions on the preponderance of evidence, the requirement used for civil trials. The vast majority of the surveyed institutions were in compliance on the standard, although it is different than the higher beyond a reasonable doubt standard that would apply in criminal proceedings. You're an attorney by training. Help us understand the nuances as these two standards play out, and if they have consequences for the survivors, for the alleged perpetrators, and for campus officials who have to deal with these issues.
Yeah, so to be clear, there's obviously one standard, the preponderance of the evidence, which is just more likely than not. All things being equal, if the scale slightly tips in one direction, that's how you decide a case. And the standard is very appropriate for campus judicial proceedings because they are more like a civil kind of hearing. We are just adjudicating whether there's been misconduct on campus. Would be the same standard if there were other issues. Beyond a reasonable doubt, obviously, is not appropriate at all. That's for criminal hearings. A lot of backlash from the movement to address campus sexual assault has been pushing for clear and convincing evidence. That's a very rare standard, even within the legal community. So the preponderance standard is both the norm, as the survey found, and we actually knew that prior. But it is the appropriate standard for addressing this. A lot of people just think because it's an issue that also happens to be a crime that it should somehow have a higher standard. But that's just not true. We are just determining whether misconduct has occurred on campus, whether a campus handbook has been followed, and it is nothing more than that on campuses. So I'm glad that 85% of schools are complying. We always knew 15% of the schools had higher standards, and it's no surprise that those schools are elite colleges where they are looking to retain their student population. And very bluntly, there's a history of discrimination against women that's pretty entrenched.
But Laura, I'm sure that there are many on campus and off who, as they hear about this issue, just wonder, why not turn this all over to a criminal process? Why do we need the campus process at all?
We need both. And for very different reasons. So obviously the criminal process is to take criminals off the street, and anyone who knows anything about sexual assault knows that majority of cases never successfully prosecuted. The majority of people who are committing sexual violence don't spend a day in prison, and that's an unfortunate failure in our criminal justice system. I'm glad that Senator McCaskill is doing some focus on reform there. There's been reform since the 70s. We used to have it where women used to have to physically resist to their utmost for there to be criminal prosecution. I mean, the standards have just always been unreasonable. But the campus process is very necessary because students still have a right to access their education. And we already have other issues that are addressed by campus proceedings. We don't want students that are academically dishonest, and we have hearings for them. We don't want students that have committed crimes off campus to remain on campus. Schools have the authority to remove students that don't represent the values of their student population. This is no different than anything else colleges have ever done in the past. It's just a limited remedy. Title IX is only protecting students to access their ongoing education. It's not sending students away to prison. It's not doing anything so extreme. And as one of the previous speakers pointed out, a lot of these students that are kicked out, they just go to a different college. It's not as if their life has been detrimentally impacted forever.
All right, let me turn to a different topic, to Scott and to Kevin. The survey, the report strongly endorses surveys about the sexual climate on campus and notes it's just a fifth of the nation's largest public colleges and universities and an eighth of the largest privates conduct annual surveys. And while there's no doubt that the data would be very helpful and very useful in terms of planning campus education programs and initiatives, you know, this seems also to offer the risk of a double-edged sword, that inevitably when the data go public, someone somewhere will compile a list of the top 10 campuses for sexual violence. Is that a fair concern, Scott?
Well, I mean, yes, I'm sure people will compile lists. They compile lists of everything, and journalists, my field, are certainly offenders there. On the other hand, we have a situation here where we have some advocates like Laura saying, hey, this is a huge problem and colleges are dropping the ball. We also have a lot of college leaders saying, yes, it's a problem, but it's not as big as is being suggested. I'm not sure it's so crazy to do a survey to find out, do students, what level of comfort or discomfort do they feel? Do they know where they would go if they were assaulted? This is sort of information that you could have, and that's why I think the senator and others are pushing for it.
And Kevin, the value of climate surveys in terms of thinking about
the value is the value is extremely high, and I think it's been we're at a place now where the best practice in this area is that a campus should have a campus climate survey, and I think you're seeing see a lot of movement in this area. I don't happen to be in favor of a federally mandated survey, but we don't need to get into that issue. I think it provides really valuable information for campuses to see how they're doing, how students are experiencing the campus, and if you're going to employ a lot of training and a lot of education, how else would you assess the progress you're making without some sort of baseline? So I think, these campus climate surveys are critical. They're identified now as really best practice, and I think they should be implemented at all institutions. And campus climate, of course, includes sexual assault, but also includes other issues related to race, ethnicity, and other kinds of issues that occur on campus as well. I do also think, on Scott's point, we need better data. We do need data which is different than a campus climate survey about the prevalence of sexual assault on campus. We have, and I think that's a place where the federal government could be more involved.
Scott, I have a sense that you'd like to get one last comment in about data before we go to other topics.
Yes, you really do need to be careful about how this stuff is used. So, for instance, a college that sees a sharp increase in reports of sexual assault, it may be a result that the college got much better at encouraging women who've been assaulted to report. That's a
Absolutely.
Good thing that they're encouraging the reporting. And a place with no reports, to me, it raises the question of are people being told how to report? Not that that's the safest campus in America. So there are nuances in how you interpret results of data in this area.
Yeah, and I think your point's great. Excellent point on those.
Let me turn to a different, another topic, and that is that the report makes a very strong case, quote, the prevention and response prevention and response education for students can drastically lower the incidence of sexual assaults, both by educating potential perpetrators about what constitutes sexual assault and also by educating future bystanders on how to recognize and safely intervene to prevent sexual assault. So, unlike faculty, staff, or even student-athletes who might be compelled, I mean, one of the questions that occurs in any kind of initiative in terms of education programs for students, whether it be about sexual violence, about alcohol, about other kinds of issues, is you can offer the program, but will the students pay attention? I mean, Kevin, let me turn to you on this, because a lot of this falls under the domain of student affairs administrators. Whether it's alcohol or sexual violence, is there good evidence that these programs will draw students and be effective?
Two aspects. First of all, there's an amazing amount of really creative work being done by victims advocates groups and peer groups on campus trying to address this issue. So I think you're seeing a lot of innovation taking place in here. Rutgers is certainly an example that's been highlighted, Northwestern, University of Northern Colorado. But I think the real key here, and the Department of Justice can help here in funding some efforts to really assess the efficacy of these programs. So you can do a lot of things, but what we really need to find are what are evidence-based practices that really make a difference in changing the culture and behavior of sexual assault on campus. That's where we need some more resources.
And Laura, again, your group is an advocate on behalf of survivors in terms of the value of these kinds of programs?
Yeah, I think the programs obviously are very important. The Clery Act has been requiring schools to have policies about their educational practices for quite some time, and just this last year, the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization that amended Clery, we made that more explicit. Schools don't just have orientation requirements now for new incoming students and employees, but they actually have a requirement to provide ongoing educational programs, and the law even broke it down. We need bystander intervention. We need messages about consent, and it's becoming more explicit. I think what colleges need to realize, though, is that you're not actually just required to give training to students or to the faculty directly, maybe in student affairs that are getting the reports. You actually need to start to train your campus officials, because what I see most often as an advocate on campus that is so deeply disappointing is even if a school has an amazing prevention education program, when the victim actually reports and goes through the process, it is so re-traumatizing and poorly focused on addressing the correct issues that at the end of the day, campuses know whether there's going to be justice or not given to survivors. So you can have an amazing prevention education program, but if you actually have a process that meaningfully and respectfully deals with this issue, that your campus is actually still failing even despite those efforts.
Laura, let me turn this on the other side, though, in terms of you're talking about campus initiatives. What needs to be done to bring students into these programs?
Quite frankly, I've never bought the argument that it's hard to get students to come into these events because schools have a lot of power about what they can mandate and require. Just to get out of law school, I was required to do an exit interview because of my federal loan. I bet you every single student did that federal interview because it's the only way you got your diploma. There's lots of things schools can do to attract students, make this a serious issue, to have this initial education have every single student affected. You should not be bringing anyone on your campus unless they've gone through some training prior, because the majority of sexual assaults happen right off the bat within that first month. You should be training before the first day of school for every student that's been accepted. And then as far as the ongoing prevention and education programs, those can be smaller programs that are targeting different populations. And in fact, if you're smart and you're really complying with the idea behind Title IX, you are using those programs to target areas where there is kind of repeat patterns of a hostile environment or some suspicion of that activity.
So, Scott, what happens next? You know, we know that this is clearly a hot issue for presidents. They're going to have to address it. None of them necessarily want to deal with it. It looms very large in the wake of the administration's initiative and also in terms of the report from Senator McCaskill. As we're in the summer and we look to the fall, are we going to see new initiatives? Are we going to see accelerated initiatives? Are we going to see potentially, as Laura has suggested, mandated programs for students during orientation?
Well, certainly Senator McCaskill and others on the Hill have said they plan to propose new legislation. Most of the higher ed lobby has said they do not want new legislation. And so I think we're going to see a debate on will new requirements help or not. College leaders tend to talk a lot about paperwork that is required as opposed to actually fixing things. And I think you're going to see some of that debate. But there's no doubt, I think we are going to see legislation.
If you could wave the wand, what's the single most important thing that a campus could do going into fall 2014? Kevin, let me begin with you.
Okay, first thing I'd say is, you know, we can't wait for legislation. We've got students coming in the fall, so we need to do what we're doing right now. Most campuses that I know have spent the last 2 months since the April report revising handbooks, instituting training for faculty and staff, revising orientation, creating peer groups. So we need a full-scale effort that is long-lasting, that is, you know, that regardless of legislation, that gets at addressing what is really one of the most critical issues on campus for student safety and well-being. And so I think is that every single campus should be digging into this, looking at compliance and looking at their educational requirements, beginning first day of school this fall, right now.
Laura, single most important thing that campuses should be doing in fall 2014 as students come back or new students arrive?
To be honest, I'm not going to focus on what campuses should do. I'm going to focus on what the federal government should do. I actually do believe campuses already have the laws they need to comply with. I believe they already have the resources they need to comply with. And I actually believe for the first time ever that students know of their rights more than they ever have because of journalism, because organizations like Know Your Nine. I actually think the missing component in addressing this issue comes from the federal government having lax enforcement. I actually want to see penalties and consequences. We need to have more complaints. I know a lot of colleges won't like that, but colleges have had these laws. They have had capabilities. They don't need more money from the Department of Justice. They don't need more funding. They have tons of funding. They have tons of faculty. They have tons of time this summer to get ready. So what I want to see in the fall is actual meaningful enforcement from the federal government for schools who just don't want to get in line and follow the law.
Great. Laura Dunn, Executive Director of Serve Justice, Kevin Kruger, President of NASPA, thank you for joining us for this conversation about this very important and in many ways very controversial topic. And that's our program for this week. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio streamer podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the This Week webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.